The reception starts at 6:30 p.m. The program starts at 7. Admission is free.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings.
Have you heard about WBAI's discount program offering you savings on your prescribed medications? You can download your free discount card from WBAI.org. Every time you use it, you will save on your cost. And at the same time, you will be helping to support WBAI Radio. There is no extra cost, pledge, or subscription required. WBAI will receive $1.75 from NDC every time you use the card. Your collective participation in this program will help build a healthier WBAI. Check it out on WBAI.org and download your card today.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, inviting you to participate in a national international reparations summit, April 9th through the 11th in New York, with Professor Hillary Beckles, representatives of the CARICOM's Reparations Commission, and reparations advocates from the Caribbean, Central and South America, Canada, and Europe. Join us for a welcome rally at Mother AME Zion Church in Harlem, a benefit tribute to Congressman John Conyers with keynote speaker Danny Glover, hosted by 1199, and a climatic closing rally at First AME Zion Church in Brooklyn. Join us in welcoming our sisters and brothers from the Pan-African world for this historic Reparations Summit, April 9th through the 11th in New York. For the full schedule and program, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org, or call 718-429-1415. That's 718-429-1415.
They are with us in the home. it is the ancestors' word in the voice of the water.
Don't worry, Mother, it'll be all right. Don't worry, Sister, say your prayers and sleep tight. It'll be fine, lover of mine. Just fine. Lend your voices only to sounds of freedom. No longer lend your strength to that which you wish to be free from. Fill your lives with love and bravery, and you shall. Heard your anguish, I've heard your heart's cry out. We are tired, we are weary, but we aren't worn out. Set down your chains till only faith remains. Set down.
You're listening to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, and I'm here in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
Hello, Paulette. And we also have a very special guest this evening. And we are joined on the line by the one and only Dennis Bernstein. Welcome, Dennis. Are you there? No.
I'm here.
Hello, Dennis. Hello. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. I am delighted to hear you.
Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Love being here. I'm in the city now. I'm very excited.
So we have our special event coming up on Saturday.
Yeah.
And so we'll be celebrating the life and work of our beloved Robert Knight.
In a public celebration.
In a public celebration.
With music and poetry and friendship and no alcohol.
Absolutely, and a few video clips and humor, and it should be a very beautiful event. And just so that there are people who are listening who may not know about it, we're going to be having a public tribute in memory of Robert Knight on Saturday, March 28th at the Riverside Theater in Manhattan, which is located inside Riverside Church. And the street address for the theater is 91 Claremont Avenue near West 120th Street. And we're going to have a reception that starts at 6:30 p.m. and a program that starts at 7 and ends at 9. And it's a free event, and people should feel free to come and enjoy the festivities.
And, like, say if nobody ever, some people listening never heard of Robert Knight, who would you tell him Robert was is?
Wow. Robert was so many things. An extraordinary journalist, a humanitarian, a civil rights activist, an anti-war activist, a logician, a scientist in his spirit, an engineer, an artist.
A comedian.
Did you say stand up? Yeah, thank you. Wouldn't want to leave that out.
I know. He was all of that and more. And a poet.
Yeah. Did we say astrologist?
Yes, indeed. An astronomer, a lover of the space science, a lover of physics, astrophysics, all of that. And the planet and environment. Pardon?
Environment, mm-hmm. Of course. In fact, one of the most formative experiences that I had was when I was with Robert, one of maybe 26 million BAI reporters who were covering the long time ago protest against the Shoreham nuclear reactor that was being built. A little craziness. And Robert, I did my first interview ever, I'll tell you about that in a second, that I ever did for news that day. But the piece that Robert did taught me a great deal about the nature of radio and the nature of sound. And Robert's exquisitely beautiful piece was recorded on a boat being rowed by two civil disobedients who were crossing the little water to go on to the actual land base where the reactor was being built.
Wow.
Robert interviewed them on the way over as they were rowing.
Wow.
And you could hear the water and the oars and the heavy breathing.
Oh my.
As the dialogue unfolded. It was a most beautiful musical portrait in resistance. And that was a lesson on how to do live radio on the scene.
Wow.
It just so happened that I was in the right place at the right time. And when the Clearwater pulled up on the river, on the water, parked about 50 yards, maybe 100 yards out. And who comes climbing off the boat with his pants rolled up and his banjo on his back? But Pete Seeger. I had a dream that I would interview Pete Seeger. And there he was. It was just me with my tape recorder and him walking in from the ship.
Wow.
And I said, Pete, this is, I think it may have been the first time Robert and I were ever together in the news.
Oh, wow.
And I said, Pete Seeger, I'm Dennis Bernstein, WBAI. I didn't even know, I wasn't even sure of the letters. And I remember I was so amazed. I was wondering, what do I ask Pete Seeger? I hadn't planned. Even though I dreamed it, I hadn't planned it. So I said, Pete Seeger, let's just say, you know, what would you want to tell the kids? What would you want to tell the future about the importance and power of solar energy? And that, what would you want them to sort of, what kind of actions might the kids take? And he outlined all the tools they would need, all the things they would need to build their first solar collector.
Wow.
It's beautiful. And so I was on the radio for the first time on the news, and I saw Robert at work.
Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful day. I wish we could find the tape of that somewhere.
I was just going to ask you that. Is that audio still around, either one? See, that would be so cool.
Now you're getting to be a radio person. Is there sound for that?
What year was that?
What year? Maybe somebody listening out there can tell us what year the Shoreham protests.
Hmm.
There was a series of protests, but BAI did a major coverage of the first big protest.
Perhaps we can look it up on the internet.
I just don't remember. I'm too old.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
You're Dennis. Wait, hold on there.
I don't know how much I want to admit to. Yeah.
What?
So, Dennis, talk to us about how you and Robert came to be working together on the air here at WBAI.
How we first started working together?
Yeah. You know, as in partnership.
Well, it wasn't partnership exactly. The first was when I volunteered when he was doing evening news. You mean that or the other unconscious stuff, which was later. The volunteering in the news department was amazing because Robert very quickly discovered that I was incapable of writing or even understand what a sentence was. I really did. I was profoundly dyslexic. I had talked my way through college, but I couldn't write a half a word. And Robert, rather than embarrassing me, he gave me this copy, this wire copy to rewrite. And he came back 20 minutes later and I was still on the first line. And he looked at me and he said, sound. You're a master of sound. He knew I was a poet and I was working in the drama and literature department before I had come to news. And he said, go collect me as many different kinds of sounds of related to news you can find. So I would go out looking for sound every Sunday morning. I was like a fisherman in the streets of New York City at protests, wherever something was happening, I'd show up with my tape recorder, get some great sound, bring it back to Robert. He'd say, great! And he'd write right around it, and I felt really important.
Wow.
It took me another 10 years when I arrived.
Well, it seems that you have mastered that art, and mastered the art of news.
It took a while, but then of course when coming together with Robert around Undercurrents, around Breaking Iran Contra was of course what threw us into, put us at the crossroads of history together. I was, in 1986, I had left radio and I was doing investigative reporting for major markets, for major newspapers. I was breaking Iran Contra story and for alternative news. So I was writing for the Newsday and for the San Francisco Examiner, which was a real paper back then. And the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which actually, at this time, there were some serious editors at the national level who were working with freelancers. So I was breaking this story about Oliver North, about this guy in the basement of the White House planning undermining the Nicaraguan revolution and working with drug traffickers. And I broke a major story, a series of stories. And then I came back to BAI because I knew I couldn't even come close to getting the material that I needed to get out in the mainstream, even though people were quite interested. So I came back and I began to work with the then program director, Andrew Phillips, in putting out my material. And I started coming in at 8 o'clock in the morning and doing these half-hour reports. And about, you know, I don't know, about 4 days into it, you know, I hadn't seen Robert for years, I guess. About 4 days into that, Robert just walks into the studio at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, Robert doesn't get up at 8 o'clock in the morning for anything in particular.
Well, probably he had still been up.
Yeah. He was gone to sleep.
Yeah, I should say, he strolled in from the other room after probably doing 6 hours of recording.
Yeah.
Anyway, he came into the studio and he just sat in the back of the studio and he was just like sort of somewhere between excited and amazed. And he said, I'll never forget this. It was like, after we, you know, we did that, I did that broadcast and we sort of were just talking. And he said, Dennis, I think you're going to be bringing me back to the work that I love.
Hmm.
And, I don't know. It was just it was a beautiful moment. It was sort of like I had put a fire under him.
Well,
and you know, once Robert was ignited, you know, that was it. It was like burning forever. And not that he hadn't been ignited before, but I think he was a little bit down.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking for the next big thing to do, and this was just obviously what he was looking for. So we came together and really made significant history together, breaking key aspects of the Iran Contra scandal. And probably some of the people listening now heard those early shows, knew what we did. It is interesting, and we should be given credit somewhere. It was, you know, WBAI at the time that we came together to do this Contragate show was in a desperately horrifying financial situation. Does that sound familiar? And it was the show and the excitement about new work and investigative reporting and blowing a hole in the Reagan, you know, Teflon that literally ignited a revolution. I'll never forget the first fund drive we did, you know, something like 4 months into this story. And they literally couldn't get enough people to answer the phones.
Wow.
People just went crazy because they know how important it is to have a cutting-edge investigative unit on the front lines who are not following corporate orders. And we were in the right spot at the right time. You know, the New Yorker, Elle Magazine, the Nation Magazine put our names on the cover to protect these. Everybody was, you know, just really amazed that we had tied into something. And I think we did a bit of changing history.
I do. And I think you kind of created the template for a lot of programs that are now in the public radio media that are patterned after what you two did. You know,
well,
people are still trying to catch up, I think.
I think that's very true. One of the things that I decided early on, and Robert had no problem with it, was that we were not going to let not getting perfect or pristine sound get in the way of some of the most important information getting out to the people. So we would talk to people on crummy phone lines in El Salvador. I mean, we had our correspondent is on a crummy phone line inside the union headquarters in San Salvador when there was a huge explosion outside. There was some kind of car bomb. What it was somebody had put a bomb under our correspondent's truck.
Oh, my gosh.
In the rooms while he was inside talking to us on the radio. You know, Robert was on, we were both on the line with the foreign minister, the finance minister, I can't remember which one, of Panama when the station was blown off the air.
Wow.
So we really, the idea was to get there first, not with the most precious sound and the most sort of cutely cut story. And but that frontline kind of reporting, that cutting edge stuff, that we're going to be there now, obviously was the model, let's be real here, was the model for Democracy Now, among a lot of other shows that you hear, you know, all over Pacifica and on community radio stations on the internet. You know, sort of like find the people who know the most about it and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And don't let anything else get in the way. I'm trying to make sure that I don't curse. Have I cursed here?
Please don't.
I'm so comfortable talking to my friend here. I'm about to start cursing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Sometimes it gets so close, but we need to.
Well, I promise I won't. Just make sure that I don't, though.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you a little bit later on also, you know, because you have, I remember when you first moved out to the West Coast, and, you know, you started your own revolution over there in a way, and I would be interested in hearing more about that, because I do know that you put together some of the most revolutionary and challenging stories on what's going on in the Middle East with Israel, Palestine, and the like. And I would love for you to let our listeners know what that journey has been for you.
That has really been the journey, most rewarding, most troubling. As you say, Yiddish caused me the most stress because, you know, being the grandson of a rabbi that wrote prayer and blessed matzah, and being the most outspoken, the most high-profile speech for a Palestinian voice, they didn't really go together.
Mm.
But I learned a lot, and the more people tried to attack me and crush me, the more I realized how important that story, how that was a linchpin story for peace in the world. And that would be the, you know, Palestinian liberation. And really my coverage of the Middle East, you know, became laser on Palestine after, you know, the multiple wars in Iraq. In covering the Middle East, I had some extraordinary opportunities. I was working for Pacifica, and I had started as soon as the first war in 1990 or 91 broke out, I started a show at KPFA called Daylight in Baghdad. And it was a midnight show because it was at midnight there, it was daylight in Baghdad, and the bombs were falling, and so I would be doing a lot of reporting and passing it on for folks through the day. And in that context, I reported some of the most troubling stories that I never really wanted to know so much about, but had no choice, which included great amounts of suffering. I'm thinking of one experience, how you sort of come into these things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Many years of reporting, so you may remember that Bush did his first Gulf War, and when he was done and so-called Kuwait was liberated, George Bush decided he was going to go celebrate liberation in Kuwait. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Liberation in Kuwait. You know, I guess he would sit on gold toilet seats, all-male gold toilet seats, and celebrate the liberation, you know, of the 10% of the population, because the rest of the population, you may remember, of Kuwait before that war, two-thirds of the population of Kuwait was Palestinian before the war. This U.S. planned war was all about, among other things, there were many plans besides controlling the resources It had to do with purging the Palestinians from Kuwait. Did you know that was a part of U.S. strategy in the first Iraq War?
I did not know
that. The Israelis were nervous. And so one of the big stories that I broke working with Pacifica and the then called the Pacific News Service, it's now New American Media, I obtained a Pentagon document. This was a secret 300-page document that I was given by a very disgruntled member of the CIA. And this Pentagon document, it showed how the United States was triggering the war and was planning for it. In fact, this document had in it, well, follow me on this, this, remember those oil fires that were started after the first Gulf War?
Yeah.
You know, well, in this Pentagon document, before that war started, they had already identified the six top oil firefighting companies in the world.
Wow.
To be prepared to go put out the fires that they would say were started by, I guess, the same people who discovered the babies of the respirators that really didn't die because there were never any babies mm-hmm. in the respirator, even though the Kuwaiti ambassador's wife testified before Congress. One of the ways that they got the U.S. people to say, oh, we got to go to war because they're killing babies in respirators.
Yeah, I remember that.
These were, and what happened, everything in this document that was outlined happened. There was a purge. There was a brutal, bloody purge of the Palestinians in Kuwait by the tens of thousands. They were tortured, beaten, shot. There's an incredible, I know we haven't heard a lot about this, but there is really a quite incredible story by the Time journalist Robert Fisk of the Independent of London, in which he talks about being outside one of these schools in Kuwait where Palestinians are being tortured, and he can hear the screams, but he can't go inside because the schoolhouse where they're being tortured, the Palestinians, for supposedly information, they're traitors, terrorists. He couldn't get in there. Fisk couldn't get in because there were two Americans guarding the door.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
While the Palestinians were being tortured by the Kuwaitis and supervised by the CIA.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, so that's some of the, you know, some of the kind of reporting that I found myself in the middle of. And one other thing, you remember that I was saying about Bush 1 going back and celebrating liberation? When he went back, you may remember, there was revelations. Clinton had just taken control. He hadn't sowed his oats yet. He didn't have his first war under his belt yet.
Mm.
And there was a so-called CIA revealed the plot that Bush was going to be assassinated when he went to celebrate liberation in Kuwait for, like, you know, all rich white males. So Clinton, wanted to sow his oats, decided, what the hell? Want to make sure that it was safe for Georgie, his predecessor. So he did a little bombing. Anybody remember that? He did a little bombing.
I remember.
Of Iraq as soon as he came in. Yeah. And mm-hmm. one of his bombs, remember, Hillary was liberation, women's liberation, all that kind of stuff. She's fighting for women and all that. One of Bill's oat-sowing bombs mm-hmm. killed the director of the Iraqi National Museum. Leila Al-Attiyah,
mm-hmm.
who was significant in bringing women into the art scene in the Middle East. But Bill Clinton's bomb landed on her house.
Wow. Yeah.
So she was the director, the woman's director of the Iraqi National Museum was killed. In the rubble, pulled out after 5 hours, was Layla's daughter, Rima. Rima had visions of being an artist. But once they pulled her out, they found out after many operations that she would lose one eye.
She moved to the United States to have these operations and lived in San Jose near Stanford. So Bill Clinton used to fly over Rima's house to visit Chelsea at Stanford.
Wow. Ironic. Irony.
But you'd think maybe he'd want to pull the helicopter down in front of Rima's house and go in there and apologize. Maybe he could have, he and Chelsea could have had lunch with Rima and tell her how bad they felt.
Hmm. Wow.
These are the kinds of stories.
Yeah, very amazing, very, very compelling. And the situation doesn't seem to be much better. If you have the energy for it, I know it's late. I would love to get a sense of what the situation is right now for our listeners in Palestine and with the Palestinian people.
In Palestine, well, you know, Yemen, I don't even know where to start at this point.
Okay.
Just to give it a one-liner, I mean, we are entering into a phase that sort of guarantees that we're going to be in a state of war for another 20 years.
Wow.
It's going to get so much worse before it gets even worse than that. Mm-hmm. We are in a very bad time. It is terrifying. And frankly, you know, the neocons know what they want, but Obama doesn't know what the hell he wants. He doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't have a clue. And it's sort of, you know, it almost feels like he wishes he didn't have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense. I think that is, it looks like he doesn't really want to deal with much of anything. But, you know, it's interesting. This is a really terrible situation, and I have found myself somewhat frustrated with the, so-called left, where, like you said, the neocons know what they want, and they're very organized and regimented and, you know, walk lockstep, and they do what they want, and they get their agenda in order. And it seems that the left is a big mess, if there is such a such a left at all anymore. I don't know if there is, but I don't see anywhere, maybe you've seen this, where there's a real conscious movement to put an end to all of this violence in the Middle East. Are you aware of anything that's happening in the world that people could sort of put their attention on?
Well, in the macro, not really. I'm really wanting people to stay educated. I'm wanting people to learn as much as possible about some of the realities. I think that's pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
I am, you know, back to Israel-Palestine. This may sound odd to you, but it's in the context of what's going on in the world, it's the most hopeful.
Yeah, really?
Because particularly the way in which the boycott divestment movement is taking off, I think that a combination, you know, the last Israeli slaughter, you know, killing 2,000 children, 2,000 people, more than half of them children, you know,
mm-hmm.
Like UN compounds, thousands, tens of thousands of, you know, all the deaths. You know, that was pretty tough for the world to see. And I think, I just think that there is a very strong force behind boycott divestment, and that is where, you know, that's where the South, the anti-apartheid movement picked up.
Yeah, it's, when you take away the finances, it's a powerful thing.
So if you want a positive something, you know, I can at least say on the micro, is very positive, that boycott divestment movement and its unity with, you know, those who fought in South Africa is a beautiful thing to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, you know, the phony war on fundamentalism, you know, where the fundamentalists are the ones in Washington leading the war.
Yeah.
We've really pushed this, you know, like just to look at a few things in terms of that seem to be on the periphery but are so deeply a part of what's going on. See, you've got the Kurds with dreams of their own state now, right? Mm. But how many Kurds are in Iraq? Is it 5 million? How many Kurds are in Iran? I don't know, is it 7 million? Is it 10 million?
I don't know.
How many Kurds are in Turkey? Is it 10 million? Is it going to be, you think Turkey wants a Kurdish state? In the middle of all this other stuff. But the United States thinks, because they don't know what, they don't have a clue what to do, they think, well, we can trust the Kurds. So now that we've created a religious war between the Sunnis and the Shia, let's see what we can do with the Kurds. I mean, and it's, you think Turkey's going to stand by for the new Kurdistan?
Not likely.
Kurds, I mean, that's not even thinking about Syria, the disappearing border between Syria and Iraq. What's the relationship between, you know, what kinds of things is Israel going to come up with? Because obviously they're all about Hezbollah and Iran. You know, who's going to, who, and by the way, while everybody's watching Netanyahu talk about needing to nuke Iran before they get nukes, the real problem is that everybody's got nukes in the Ukraine, and that's pretty hot.
Mm.
That's as close to a hot wall with nukes in the background that you can find.
Wow! So
seriously,
yeah.
I'm not talking about anything in particular. Really, I'm just saying that there are fuses lit everywhere, and people don't know when the different explosions are going to go off. But it's going to get really messy in this world.
Well,
and all, we haven't talked about Africa, but you know, AFRICOM, why is everybody so interested in, you know, I think I'll leave it. It goes on. I will say this. All the stuff that we're talking about now, all the issues that I've tried to raise here, are issues that Robert dealt with such vision. He was so far ahead of his time. Mm. You know, when we were all following in the Contras in Nicaragua, he had created a Contra parallel Contra map for Contras everywhere. And so, you know, when Robert talked about Contras, he was talking about Jonas Savimbi.
Mm.
He wasn't talking about, you know, Somoza, per se. And making those kinds of connections was incredible, that it's one policy fits all.
Yeah.
Subversion, suck up the resources, and create a military structure to enforce your control.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, and Robert also, you know, continue to do those stories here on the 5 o'clock shadow.
Right.
Once that program started. And even during that long period when he wasn't on the air here, he was doing a segment into your program, I believe Flashpoints, out in at KPFA. He was doing a program called The Night Report, I think it was.
Yeah.
Right, it was how we opened the show.
Yeah.
And it was the Night Report, which I'm going to take credit. I named it. He says, "What should we call it?" So it's Night Report. What the Night Report? is what I want. He says, "Okay, the Night Report. You got it."
Mm.
And it was just the most astounding 3 to 5 minutes. Sometimes, you know, he would go 7 of unbelievably well-wrought prose, full, condensed. You know, it's like you make a, I guess, an atom bomb, like you condense it until it explodes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Robertson, those Night Reports were just fabulous openings to the Flashpoint show. Sometimes they would lead into the show. They would set up the show. Sometimes they would just do their own show. Sometimes I'd have Robert stay on. He would do it live sometimes, and I'd have him stay on and talk to him after, which was always wonderful. And people really, really appreciated that. The only people who didn't were the the news department.
I know, it's really next, rather because, ironic.
You know, it's sort of embarrassing, you know, to have someone brilliant and you be reading, doing a second-rate reading of Wire copy.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what happens when ego supersedes talent. And
yeah.
I really see that as one of the real problems with the organization of the left. It's all about, who's on top. A little bit of power struggle in many of the movements of the left, almost to the point of losing sight of the goal. And it leaves me wondering what to do. I find myself wanting to retreat from any political movement because I don't see it working.
Well, I don't want you to retreat.
You don't want me to retreat.
I think my poetry teacher Muriel Rukeyser said to me once, you know, you can make if you act expecting something to happen, you can make a fool of yourself many times over.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you act because in the name of truth and what's fair and righteous, and it doesn't necessarily mean that will mean anything to anybody, and it may be ignored by those who you wish most would be able to listen to you.
Yeah.
But I know Robert felt like this. The idea is to wake up every morning, be a little less violent, and try and make something beautiful.
Mm.
Make something that is worthy that wasn't there the day before.
Well,
that's all we can do,
right? Yeah. Well, that I can, given in that context, it makes complete sense to me. I just wanted to let people know that you're listening to a program we've been calling Earth at Midnight over WBAI in New York. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with Paulette Spencer, and on the phone we're speaking with Dennis Bernstein, who is the producer at this time of Flashpoints at KPFA. And if you want to hear more of Dennis, you can hear him on our air on Fridays from 5 to 6 p.m. where I think we have like a best of Flashpoints broadcast. So hopefully people will tune into that and connect to some of the work that you're doing out at our sister station at KPFA. I've been dominating this conversation, Paulette. So sorry. Go ahead. Do you have a question for Dennis? And Dennis, we are keeping you up. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, I'm still on California time.
Oh, okay.
It's early for me. my computer here says 9:53.
So we're safe.
Yeah,
I just wanted to elaborate on some of the points that you brought up regarding Robert's sort of preparedness. Because we, as you called your show Daylight in Baghdad, a joke that I guess over time I grew to understand Robert more, because I knew that he would be up in the middle of the night or really early morning with his computer. And I never understood, well, it took me a while to understand why he would do that. And his logic was, if he got up early enough to get the first printing or the first reporting of what's happening on the other side of the world, he would be ahead of everyone else.
Yep.
And that was his strategy.
It's much easier to be, it's much harder to you know, counteract, or if you will, be a reactionary journalist. It doesn't have the impact. As in, somebody does an ugly story and then you react with something that might be a bit more substantive. Hmm. But the idea is you put the story on the record and let them react to it.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think we could all learn from that.
Without a doubt.
First cut is the deepest.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And also, one of the things I've noticed just from watching the news is that the stories change throughout the day. It's almost like people come in and say, oh, no, we can't say this, we can't say that. So from the morning, early morning, you'll hear something very powerful. By the end of the day, either the story's gone or it's been completely changed. I've noticed that in the mainstream media.
It could be, you know, it can be very frustrating, because I know that you both feel and have had this response to corporate media, which is that every once in a rare while, somebody tells the truth. Right?
Yeah.
And you go, you're all standing around and you go, wow! Did he just say that?
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, what am I trying to say? I think it's, you know, what time is it?
1256. It's almost 1 a.m. So I think you just passed through California time into jet lag.
It never helps. Let me come back this way. You know, New York Times puts the garbage on the cover and then the retraction on page 19 at the bottom left corner. So it doesn't help to get them to retract. The idea is to say it first and say it loud. And you know, you mail it down. Rupp was so good at this.
Oh yes.
You don't make up the story. You make sure you get the facts right. But once you've got them, you hit them with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, it was very important, I would say central to his reporting, for his credibility to be able to present you with evidence behind his analysis. And that's right. Something that I picked up, I guess, since the very first time that I listened to Robert. And it was actually you and Robert I listened to together on in the early 90s. I mean, I learned all about Palestine and Iraq from you and Robert between the shows, stuff that was done in California and BAI here in New York. So you were an integral part of my education. But I always appreciated the fact that throughout Robert's career, what was important was not just what he said, but for you to listen to the evidence and then weigh what he said with what your lying ears just told you and come up with your own analysis, your own interpretation of reality. And I think that's right. Part of what made him a really extraordinary journalist.
Hmm. Maybe we should remind people about the memorial coming on Saturday.
Yes, please.
Sure. So for those of you who don't know, we're going to be having a tribute, really, for Robert night on Saturday, March 28th, at the Riverside Theater, which is located inside of Riverside Church. The address is 91 Claremont Avenue, near West 120th Street.
This Saturday.
And it's free of charge. And we have a program of speakers, live music, video clips from Robert in his earlier days, comedy, poetry. I wanted to make it a happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what it will be. And it's, as they say, free of charge. 6:30, there will be a reception at the theater. And at 7 p.m. through 9, we'll have the program.
So that sounds... sounds like it's going to be so much fun. A lot of people are coming together who were powerful factors in Robert's life, such as Dennis Bernstein. I think that you and he were like
Kathy, Kathy Davis.
So it's going to be a really, I think, a very special opportunity. And, you know, the programming I do here is spiritual in nature. So I happen to think that Robert is going to be there as well. In spirit.
Yeah.
I have no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think he's gonna have to come in without the spirit.
Say that again, I'm sorry?
He's going to have to come in. He's going to be in spirit,
yes.
Without spirit.
Yeah, well, but we all know know that he's there, and so it'll be a wonderful opportunity for all of you who are listening, who had a love and respect for Robert Knight and his work to participate on Saturday, because it really is going to be a celebration of his life and contribution. So, you know, it would be wonderful for us all to be there and have a great time. And if you need information, if you missed that information, or if it's a little bit late and you yourself are in a form of jet lag, you can come back to the website, wbai.org, and on the top banner on the first opening page of the website, you will see a banner that has the information. Click on it, and you'll have all the information you need to make your way to the Riverside Church. And you could actually reserve a seat from that banner. You can click on and RSVP.
Yeah, it's not required, because we're not going to turn you away. The RSVP is only because there's a limitation on how many seats are in the theater. And so it was my way of just monitoring how many people are coming.
Well, that would be good to monitor.
But I think of Robert. Robert would never, ever accept a sort of list as a boundary, you know, for getting into an event. He would just walk in and say, I'm here.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It'll be fine, and it'll be a lot of fun, I think so. So I don't want to keep you up much longer, Dennis Bernstein. Is there anything you want to finish up with saying?
I just want to say that I'm honored to help you remember Robert. It was an honor to work with him, and I'm so glad that.
I think you have to pick up your voice a little bit.
I'm so glad that he has such good friends. We're going to honor him, remember his work, and that we can make sure that his example is passed on to future journalists who really are always desperate for a real example of a way to work. So I'm just honored to be there, and I'm looking forward to seeing the both of you and celebrating with all the folks from the WDAI family that show up on Saturday at Riverside. Looking forward to it. It's a beautiful tradition, beautiful church, and it's going to be David Allen is going to be there.
Yes, he will.
Oh my God, the father of like world music, or you know, on the radio or something. Quite brilliant musician. So that's among the extraordinary brilliance. That's something to look forward to.
Exactly. All right, so I'm just going to say good night this evening and get some rest, Dennis. Thank you very much for taking the time.
You. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Okay.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. This program is Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine with Paulette, And that piece of music you just heard was Magic and Music by Terry Lynn Carrington. Earlier, we opened with Earth by Michelle Indiacello, and we heard Breaths by Sweet Honey in the Rock, and Life Uncommon by Jewel. If you would like to join in the conversation here, you can do that. The number is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. If you want to call and perhaps say a few words, make a comment. I don't think there's a limitation on the subject, but it would be nice if you have a comment you would like to include in the dialogue we've been having. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Am I on the air yet?
You are on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Catherine and Paulette.
Good morning.
I tuned in a little bit late, but I do want to get the music down, which I couldn't quite get. So maybe you might repeat that or somehow. Maybe I could get it. Maybe you could get it to me on Saturday, actually.
Well, I won't remember it by Saturday. Magic and Music by Terry Lynn.
Okay, just one second. Let me pick up my pen. Terry Lynn Carrington.
Yes. Magic and Music was the piece I just played. Before that was Life Uncommon by Jewel. And we heard Breaths by Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Okay, great.
And really, Earth by Michelle Indiacello.
Earth by
Michelle Indiacello.
India?
N-D-E-O-C-H-E-L-L-O, I think it's spelled.
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks so much. I want to put out something that I heard shortly after we lost Robert, that I heard when there was a call, and I heard another caller bring up. And that is, he was so precious to us, and we're very holistically oriented. And I was wondering if there might be some consideration and some discussion of how we lost him. So that would, from the respect, you know, it's not a question of all the details, but from the respect of a heads up to the larger community, and particularly since we lost him while he was in a hospital, you know, there's so many things that can go wrong in a hospital. Not necessarily that it did, but I just like to put that out. Nobody
sure.
has to.
I will tell you, he had cancer, and he was diagnosed with leukemia 8 months earlier.
Oh, my.
And so he was being treated for it in the hospital, and there were complications, and that's how he transitioned.
I appreciate that, Paul. So he got a diagnosis of leukemia, which is one of the toughest cancers.
Yes.
You know, although I understand there is some sort of new treatment I heard on the news where it's a customized type of treatment. So,
yeah.
You know, right now it's expensive. And then did the cancer spread?
Well, leukemia is cancer in your blood.
Yeah.
And
yes.
So it's unchecked growth of your white blood cells.
Yeah. I see.
And so the aim is really to get your system to reset itself. And then there's a period where, you know, if after the treatment, if your blood cells grow at a normal pace within a normal range, you're considered to be in remission. But I think leukemia, I mean, I'm not any medical person, but I can describe to you exactly what leukemia is.
Yeah, I kind of have a different perspective on it, though.
Okay.
Because while it is true that he was diagnosed with leukemia, I don't believe he passed from leukemia. I think he passed from the therapy. The failure of the therapy had an impact on it, because it was really the compromise of his immune system that was the actual cause of his passing.
But
so
you're
from
right.
my perspective...
I your white blood cells, in large part, are your immune system.
Actually, yes. The immune system is all over the body, especially in the gut, too.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's something that modern medical science is still trying to understand. Really appreciate your sharing that. Was it sudden, or was it kind of expected in terms of his state at the time of his passing?
I thought it was kind of sudden.
It was sudden. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
it wasn't really expected.
Yeah, it was sudden. It was.
Yeah, that might indicate that whatever treatment that they came up with, not necessarily that you would be able to prove it, was the was more on the line of Catherine's analysis. But I'll look forward to. I mean, we lost somebody that was just so unique, and he brought something that. You know, he was like one in a trillion almost, you know,
yeah.
I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's also two ways of looking at it. There's the perspective of, I have my prejudices because I have been following the alternative medicine and the teachings of alternative medicine. And I personally would have followed a path that was more in alignment with that. And I have a great distrust for the medical system. So my perspective is very different from Paulette's perspective, who has a different understanding of actually how the science of it all works. I actually don't care.
Wow.
I think that, I just intuitively feel that the alternative perspective is better. And I really have to say that, Robert was in complete control and in complete choice. So I had to respect his decisions that he was making, and I couldn't, drag him over to what I was thinking he should do. And, he made a choice and, for his own reasons. And I think it's a bigger picture than just what happened in the hospital. There's a sort of a cosmic destiny to it. And I think that it may very well be that he just needed to be in a bigger space in the universe to be able to have a greater impact on the outcome of all of our lives.
As one of the ancestors.
Yes,
I just
think that he was at a stage where he felt that he could have a great, I mean, this is all intuitive and not even conscious, but I think that there's an element of that where there was, like, he's part of the cosmos at this, the cosmos that he loved, he's now a part of.
Yes, and let's continue his work as he looks down on us from that larger space. Thank you so much for sharing that, Paulette and Catherine.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. So we have a few more calls. Did you want to comment or go to the call?
Calls? We can call.
Let's go to our next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom from the Bronx here. I'd like to say that I was listening to the gentleman there talking about the Mideast, and if this country wants to do something humane, and they should try to buy a major portion of what is the Sinai Peninsula, because it has the same size as Israel, pretty much. It even has the same shape.
Well,
wait a minute. Now.
No, I'm sorry. No, we've had this conversation. I'm just sorry. I'm not having it again. Okay. Hello. You're on the air. Whoops. Wrong slide. For a spiritual person, I'd have not a lot of patience for some callers. I have to call myself into question here and say, wait a minute. That would not be considered very spiritual, but. The other side of spirituality is that you're not required to be a doormat or a dummy. It was a level of conversation that was not respectful to the evening, and I didn't want to get into it. Hello, you're on the air. Spider?
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
Good, how you doing, Spider?
How's my little Qigong master doing?
Oh, thank you.
I came to BAI, what it was, like 93 something. No, 83. Anyway, there's such brilliant minds at BAI.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't know where to go with this, but Robert Knight, man, he was just a brilliant spirit. He was a brilliant guy, and he was handsome, too.
Yes, he was.
And
so
like,
true.
And, like, just we had the same inseam, me and him. We, like, would talk about this. He was way skinnier than me, you know, but, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I was very surprised. Like, and, like, I always thought, like well, there's another woman, Kate Wolfe, who died of leukemia. I said, couldn't they have just kept giving her transfusions? But at some point, you realize, wait a minute. It's quality of, like, life.
Yeah, I think that's really what it comes down to for a lot of people. And Robert was, like you said, he had this radiance and this brilliance.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, to
have... light around it. Like, a lot of people at BAI have this light, like Sydney. Mm-hmm. I don't want to start naming names, you know. But there's BAI is full of brilliant people.
Yeah.
And we all should send money, $5, $10, BAI.org.
Okay.
Thank you, Spider.
Right, let me let you go. You know, I'll see you soon.
Okay, very good. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Spider was one of the first, not the only, but one of the first female engineers.
Wow.
Here at WBAI. And she, for a very long time. So that was pretty cool. And we're getting close to our end point. It's just about 20 after, and we do have a program following us, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, so please do stay tuned for that. We may very well have time for one or two more phone calls if you would like to join us at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Let me see if I can remind you of this rather special event for a rather remarkable person. So let's see if we can. That should do it. We'll be back in just a moment.
Join us on the evening of Saturday, March 28th at the Riverside Theater in Manhattan for a public tribute to WBAI's Robert Knight. We will celebrate Robert's life and 35 years of international investigative journalism with live music, colleagues, and friends, including Kathy Davis, Randy Credico, Dennis Bernstein, Margaret Kunstler, Elaine Barrett, David Amram, Terry Waldo, Roy Jennings, and a surprise guest. The Riverside Theater is located inside Riverside Church at 91 Claremont Avenue and West 120th Street. The reception starts at 6:30 p.m. The program starts at 7. Admission is free.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings.
Again, you're listening to WBAI in New York, and this is Earth at Midnight. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. How you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. Couple of comments on Dennis Bernstein's. You know, he was saying about stories, how they change.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, and it's also like in Project for the New American Century, one of our premiums, there's the issue of this girl, they show you how she's saying, and they left the babies to die in the cold, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the narrator just says, and she was trained by a public relations firm and rehearsed that line.
Yeah.
So you could see that in Project for a New American Century, that documentary.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Do you want to give let people know who you are?
This is Matt, volunteer in the premiums department at WBAI. So yeah, it's your really premiums cool. are coming. They're coming. I'm burning discs now.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Also, on Robert Knight, you know, if you remember Jim Crivo, when he passed recently, now, he was on the holistic approach. I think he went to Ann Widmore's.
Mm-hmm.
And he did well with that.
Yeah, for a long time, but ultimately, you know, the disease proved to be stronger. But
right.
He did very well for a very long time.
Yes, we got pretty friendly.
Yeah.
I was at his house a couple of times. But yes, the holistic route is the better way to go.
Okay. So I guess, you know, different opinions and different strokes. And actually, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is. So thank you.
All right. As I say, like Dr. Ali says, be your own primary care physician.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Yeah. Let's see. I think we have another caller. Oh. On the line. Whoops, wrong slide. Hello, you're on the air. Whoops, you're not.
Leukemia is concerned.
I'm sorry, start over. I just got
you. As far as leukemia and most cancers are concerned, if people change their thoughts to be more humane, more positive, less, that's one major thing as far as energy medicine. The second thing is the diet, what you put in the Temple of the Soul. So, for instance, a lot of healers are going to convene at Veggie Fest, which is happening August 15th and 16th of 2015 in Naperville, Illinois. That's in the summer, of course. And this weekend, for instance, in order to motivate more people to become vegan or vegetarian, there's a freebie. If you call 631-822-7979, you can get
okay,
it.
Thank you. Well, you know, I think everyone has a different perspective and people have to make choices according to their own beings. And, you know, my perspective is one way. It's just, it is what it is. So, what can I say? What can I say? I think it's entirely more complex though than saying that it's about being positive or eating vegetables. It's a lot more complex than that. So maybe I'm somewhere in the middle. You know, you have to look at where things come from. Things come from exposure as well. Someone could be exposed to a radiation of some kind and end up with a leukemia or another kind of disease. It wouldn't have anything to do with your diet or your emotions. And we live in a world that's full of radiation. If you could just look at everyone's cell phones, and we are not just the cell phones, there are the towers that magnify the signals of the cell phones, and you know, people are using microwaves, and there are so many factors that can go into all this.
Sure, and there are things that you unknowingly consume.
Yeah.
So there,
and then there are genetic vulnerabilities. There are just so many potentials that could lead to one getting an illness, and so I think it's almost. That's something that needs to be surrendered, because what can you do on so many cases? And people can only make choices according to their beliefs. And it is true that in many ways, conventional medicine works better than unconventional medicine in many ways and for many conditions. And very often, if you can find, if you can intervene early enough that by conventional medicine, then you can make a difference early. So, for instance, if you have breast cancer, if you intervene early, you could live a long life. But if you don't, you could die very young. So there are certain things, there are a lot of different factors. I don't think it's a simple answer. It's just that I have to kind of admit that I just have a long-standing mistrust of the medical system. So that plays into my judgment, because I've seen the misunderstanding and the sort of just the systemic problems that are there. You know, it may be that vegetables won't cure you, but having a healthy diet where you're going through a process can help you. If your system is going through a process where it's being compromised, then you build it up first. You don't break it down with garbage food and then compromise with chemical. You know, so there's a lot of shade, a lot of shades to it. I got to go. Could you let in our upcoming host? We are about to go away, and I want you to stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. We will be back next week, at least that's the plan. We'll never know how things go. But thank you, and thank you for joining us today, and stay tuned.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a very specific topic, a very important issue. I have no idea what it is, but it will emerge. But to help us along our way, our guest is Terrence Taylor. Stay tuned.
You are on my mind.
Dar Williams. What a really brilliant cover of that song, Comfortably Numb. There, it's not live yet, so you can move it. We're talking about microphones, people. They thought I was talking about a hamster.
Or a dead body.
Yeah, or a dead body, yes. Yes, the new...
It's not live yet. It's okay to touch it.
The zombie, yes. What was I saying? Well, so this is how last week's show went, and I've got to be more focused. Okay, the song Comfortably Numb sort of describes me to a certain extent. Not the drug part of it, but the way that my mind has been going. I felt that there was this vast interregnum of radio. We were... Hour of the Wolf was basically off the air for 5 weeks during the last fund drive. Actually, it was on 1 week where Ken Gale was the host. But I was not able to come in. And Ken did yeoman duty in doing a 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. special program. So I was off the air for like a month and a half, which for me is, well, forever. And people who know the history of this program may remember the days when it was not, when not only was it 5 days a week, but I also did a children's show called Kinderfantasiegeschichten, and I did a music show called Music of the Spheres, and I was a regular daytime engineer for programming here. So when we came back, the first thing was, oh, it's Douglas Adams' birthday. And I hadn't played any Hitchhikers in quite a while. And I feel a proprietary interest in that for reasons that I explained 2 weeks ago, because I was the first person on the continent to broadcast Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which many people still think mistakenly is a book. It's a radio drama. The book is a novelization. Even Douglas called it that. After that came the TV show, then there was a play, then there was a actually rather good Infocom game, except you could never get the Babelfish. It was impossible. There was no. They actually had T-shirts saying, I got the Babelfish. It took something like 17 steps in order, involving a water cooler and, of course, a towel. All kinds of things. So, had to do that 2 weeks ago. No sooner do I finish that show and go home that